Welcome to Another News. I'm Jeff Brady. Today we look back in this second part and listen to the voices of guests who were on the show talking about geoengineering, weather control, its fallout, and health effects. We start with Corey Gunnels, an anti-geoengineering activist living in Prescott, Arizona. She witnessed and photographed a low-flying C-130 military plane being closely followed by two smaller aircraft in November of 2014. Shortly after, long sticky filaments began to fall out onto her property and on the surrounding community. Corey and her neighbor Marie Snow collected samples and then alerted local environmental agencies, politicians, and nearby airports. After the media reported on her story, Corey received more accounts from others around the country describing the same types of long fibrous filaments raining down onto the surface. We listen now to part of that interview with Corey. Corey, welcome to Another News.
Thank you.
Last November, you witnessed a procession of military aircraft flying pretty low over your property in Prescott, Arizona. The story blew up in mainstream alternative news, but let's go over what happened.
Sure. It was a situation where I happened to be in the right place at the right time, meaning I was outside and had my cell phone in my hand. I had just finished a phone call, and I heard the sound of jet aircraft that was unusual. It was very loud and not something I was accustomed to hearing. I looked up and saw a very large military plane that was immediately followed by two other planes. And I've since learned that was a C-130. And on its tail, it was the configuration that was also very unusual. It was these three planes were together at a low elevation. It was a C-130, followed by a Lear 35, followed by a C-12 Huron. And I clicked my phone to camera and tried to get a shot, and luckily I was able to. I didn't have time to focus or zoom. And I went inside, called a friend of mine that lives in the direction that the planes were headed, and asked her if she could please go outside and, you know, to see if she could spot them as well. And I reached her, she did, and we were conversing on the phone. All of a sudden, you know, she was saying, oh my gosh, you know, can you see that? And I had no idea what she was talking about right at that moment. And she said, it looks like there are 50-foot-long raindrops just coming straight down over me. I still couldn't see that, but within a couple minutes, because of the prevailing wind, I'm about 8 miles to southwest. My sky literally filled with long, shimmering webs. And that's kind of where the story started. Both of us are... There's a little irony in it. Both of us are, and have been for years, anti-geoengineering activists.
Very interesting.
Right. So we, you know, there were some things we knew we needed to do. One, the first thing was to call the EPA right away and file a report. And I did that, and I did reach a woman. And the EPA is divided into regions, and our region is Region 9. With the headquarters in San Francisco. And so when I called the EPA to file a report, the woman said, because this is happening in real time, and I'm in San Francisco and you're in Arizona, I want you to call someone closer. And she gave me the phone number for Arizona Department of Environmental Quality. And she gave me an internal number as well as the main number in case, you know, I needed a backup. So I did call. I didn't reach anybody in person, but I filed an online complaint report. Within about a week, I did receive an email of confirmation and a case number from them.
Tell us exactly how you collected samples. What did it look like? Where were they?
Sure. My friend, her name is Marie Snow, she collected samples, one just straight from the air. She rolled up a piece of paper, just kind of swirled these webs around and around and around and around the paper. The webs or the filaments were so long that she said she could have stood there for a long time. She actually had to break the filament, which is stronger than a spider web, in order to stop. Then the other thing we did is collected material from the vegetation. And with that, we just used a piece of nature, you know, that it was on, like a stick. It's really difficult to gather a sample of this because it's, you know, from the air, it's in a long, you know, 20 foot long strand floating. On vegetation, it's extremely sticky. It wants to clump up. So that was the collection. And then what I actually did was to send it, I went to a veterinarian and got a sterile sample jar and put it in that and then sent it to the lab.
I see. Mm-hmm. What were the results?
This event happened on the 5th of November, 2014, and the samples were sent in shortly thereafter, and it takes about 10 days to get a report back. The report, we sent in two samples independently to a certified lab in California. I asked for the sample to be tested for aluminum and barium, and the results I received back, this is in a part per million or part per billion, and I'm sorry, I need to get that clarified. It's measured in a milligram per kilogram, that I'm sure of, and that's because it's a solid. The aluminum results were 1,020. The barium was 34.1, and strontium was 70.8.
Those are the metals that we often hear are in water and soil samples that are independently taken by geoengineering activists or concerned individuals around the country and around the world. Were there other metals or other ingredients in that?
When you submit a sample, you do need to request what you're looking for, because I'm sure the cost would be prohibitive to, you know, have hundreds of, you know, different things that they could test it for. So I'm not really sure, you know, if there are other things. There is another sample that's outstanding that's been sent for testing to check it for biologicals. You know, those three metals, the aluminum, barium, and strontium, are classic for geoengineering. They match patents. You know, we have like 150 patents for geoengineering. And, you know, there have been many, many rain, soil, snow, and blood tests that match these as well, and over time, you know, increase. So we know that the trajectory is going up in the contamination.
So you have the results back, but as far as alerting the media about this event, tell us what happened.
Well, Marie was very instrumental in that part of the story, and she contacted a number of media outlets, as well as 94 of our legislators here. The first callback came from a CBS affiliate, Channel 5 News, in Phoenix, Arizona. And we're 100 miles north of Phoenix. I was a little bit hesitant to have them do a story, because we know that the mainstream media often marginalizes stories like this, but I did have a long conversation with the assignment editor, and he assured me that, you know, he would do what he said was, quote, the straight story. So they did send a reporter, a photographer, to Prescott and also Chino Valley, which is where Marie lives, and they did a story. And they were offered to take a sample while she was with them. I wasn't with them that day during the interview. They didn't take a sample. They took a sample after the interview, after she left, and they took it to Grand Canyon University for testing, which is a small Christian college in Phoenix. I don't know why they chose that.
Grand Canyon University.
That's correct.
Mm-hmm.
So the director of the laboratory there tested the material. She put it under a microscope with 40 times magnification, and she also submitted it to a test that uses infrared. And what that does is it's a comparative analysis where they look at the chemical signature under infrared and compare it to their database. And what she said, the results came, she said that this material, unusual, she admitted it was unusual and she'd never seen anything like it before. She said that it tested for gluten, flour, and bacitracin.
Bacitracin?
Right. Hmm. So her conclusion was that these were, and I'm serious, quote, cattle bandages.
Cattle bandages. That was
That's
her.
Right. That's right. So what's interesting about that is that a sky, you know, to my knowledge, wouldn't fill with long 10 to 20 foot filaments for an hour's time from cattle bandages. And the other thing that I did ask the assignment editor, his name is Scott Davis, I asked him to please hold the story until we had all the facts, until we had our laboratory tests back. And obviously he chose not to do that. In the story, one of the important things I believe that he omitted was that he told me during that week there were three independent eyewitness observers that called their station from Phoenix reporting that they saw the same, you know, the same material in the sky. And what's important about that is that we live in very different areas. Phoenix is a desert valley, and their elevation is a little over 1,000 feet. And we're a mountain area 100 miles north, and our elevation is a mile high. It's 5,400 plus feet. So our topography is entirely different. Our climate's different. We do have historic cattle ranches there. They don't. And the other thing is that when they did the story on the news, on the, you know, television, the journalist was standing, the reporter was standing in front of a green screen with a zoomed-in photograph of a cotton field. So right there, back to mainstream media marginalizing stories, that's predictive programming. You know, that's showing their audience this is what you're seeing.
Right, that's predictive programming, the power of suggestion right there on the television. But why would cattle bandages fall out of the sky? I don't understand that.
They wouldn't. And so, you know, what I've said since about, you know, first of all, I had hesitancy to even to be part of that story, you know, part of their story. But in a way, it's almost a gift in that it's such a prime example of what mainstream media does with stories like this. It is not the straight story. You know, in my opinion, there were so many errors, and they should have waited for, you know, more factual evidence. So it's another example of, you know, particularly when you're looking at geoengineering or something like that, they're not interested in reporting the truth.
That was part of an interview with Corey Gunnels, an anti-geoengineering activist who witnessed a low-flying military aircraft releasing 20 to 50-foot filaments over a civilian population in Arizona. Corey can be found on Facebook. Her name is spelled C-O-R-I. G-U-N-N-E-L-S. As we've covered in past shows, climate scientists have been broadcasting the message to mainstream media that climate engineering would be a necessary option and that it's not in full operation. Well, that's not true. In fact, one of the purposes of this show is to provide evidence and data of the various types of large-scale geoengineering. We now hear from Alan Buckman, formerly with the California State Department of Fish and Wildlife. He's also a trained U.S. Air Force weather observer who worked in the military in this capacity for 5 years at Beale Air Force Base. He's worked with NASA, RCA, and with the U.S. Navy on the TIROS-3 weather satellite readout team. Alan describes the damage to forests caused by the climate engineering toxic fallout, specifically from the deployment of coal fly ash metals into the atmosphere that rain out into the environment. Let's go now to that interview. Alan Buckman, welcome back to In Other News.
Oh, thank you.
Well, we've had a number of calls in recent weeks when we do open lines here on the show, and the individuals are concerned about large trees that they see toppled in the forest as they're driving around upstate New York. We often relate this to climate engineering, but the evidence is very difficult to show and reveal, and there are a number of reasons for that. But this is an area that you've looked at and researched, and could you tell listeners what you found out?
Sure. What I found out is that with the combination of really high ultraviolet, it's like 1,200 times normal, and local tests with the metals, and then the trees, almost all of the trees that we've been seeing are burned, which means it's coming from a high UV levels. Now, the question of high UV levels and the potential for all of these metals to be in the soil, most plants, when you put them under stress like this, and it's obvious they're under stress, you'll start getting bark beetles, because they have little antennae on their heads that pick up the infrared, and they can see it. So they know when a tree is stressed, and that's generally when you get beetle invasion. It's also the pathway for mold, mildew, and fungus. And that stress on the trees could very easily have produced root rot, especially on the old trees. Now, there's a potential here for a whole number of different interacting situations. If you have trees that have been stressed with, say, like solar burning, and that aluminum and these other metals, which we are finding is incredibly high, some of them are in millions times higher than anything that should be. And myself, I've been testing lichens, you know, off the trees, and we're getting, you know, anywhere from 31,000 parts per million to almost 11,000 parts per million of just aluminum.
What do you attribute this excess aluminum to? A lot of the anti-geoengineering activists who have done the soil and water samples where the aluminum and barium and strontium shows up, where they specifically itemize those particular metals to be tested, and they show up. A lot of people say that these elements, these metals, aren't naturally occurring. The connection is made, especially with the patents that we see that show that aluminum oxide, barium oxide, and these metals are suspected in being used in these geoengineering operations. Is there any more evidence that we can add in here as to attribute this high level of aluminum in trees and plants?
I think so. You know, I selected lichens because lichens, you know, they're not parasitic. They get all of their nutrients from the air in either rain or snow, or out of the air itself. And when you start having incredibly high levels of aluminum in lichens, it means it's coming from the air. So this isn't a ground-based test here. It's an air-based test. And whatever they're finding in the air, quite frankly, most of the air tests I've seen, they haven't been testing for metals for the most part. At least most of the agencies, nobody's testing for all this stuff. But it's almost proof positive in my biological mind that whatever is coming down on the lichens has to be coming from the air. The only thing that we see going on overhead are the jet clouds in the spring, which has been obvious to me, you know, from the beginning. I was a weatherman in the United States Air Force, and I know what contrails are, and I know what jet clouds are, and they are really different. We used to have normal fronts come in that would be preceded by series of very specific cloud types. You know, the elevations, warm fronts have, you know, tend to bring up thunderstorms. The cold fronts tend to bring in a lot of stratiform. But overall, we're getting striped skies now and combinations of clouds that we've never seen before. Most of the sky I'm looking at aren't natural. So I'm convinced personally that this is a spray job. I really have no doubt. And the lichen testing tells me that, yes, whatever it is coming out of the air. Now, as far as the trees in New York, I'd be really curious. I don't know what kind of testing have been done on those trees, but they should be able to test the soils for metals. You probably find fungus, which would, you know, come on with the stress, and the fungus or root rot is could be amylaria, like mushrooms, which is one of the fungus that comes in on tree roots, you know, when the trees are rotting. So I'm guessing that it's the stress from the aluminum and from the high UV and from the fungus and then the pH, which also needs to be tested. But I'd like to see somebody go in there and evaluate those trees and do metal testing at the same time. And if they've got lichens, take lichen samples off of those and test those. So I don't know enough about the situation there. I'm making an educated guess about what could be there, but somebody really needs to check it.
The pH balance is interesting. An acidic soil will create a proliferation of fungus.
The aluminum is making everything more basic, but there are different kinds of fungus, and if it's not amylaria, it could be another fungus, and not all fungus are the same. It's a pretty wide, you know, even with the changes in the weather, and were we to have a total ecological collapse, there would still be surviving species. Generally, those tend to be the pathogenic types that would survive. But there would be a big shift in the ecosystem, which is what my concern is, because these metals accumulating in the soil are going to change your microclimate for all your microbial species. And when you do that, you're disrupting the entire chain of life, going all the way up from which microbes are functioning and how they interact with the trees and all the other things that are going on with it. Yes, it's complicated. However, just my weather experience, I can see the cloud spraying going on. And from the lichen test, I'm certain that it's the metals are coming from the air and they're being sprayed on us. So that's pretty much my opinion of it.
Your research in on the West Coast with trees that are undergoing the same type of stress, what have you evaluated in terms of the health of ecosystems and specifically large trees tipping over?
I haven't done a lot of investigation on that. I've been attempting to get funding to pay for the tests. They get pretty expensive. Now, we have somebody out there that wants to disprove it. They probably ought to put some money forward to evaluating what's really going on. So I wish I could say more about that, but I haven't been doing that kind of research.
We've had Dane Wigington on, and I know you were recently on a panel with Dane Wigington and others. He mentions that if they stop, then there might be a violent reaction. However, that needs to occur anyway, so there's a reset, and then hurricanes can stop being suppressed because that naturally cleans the atmosphere.
You know, if we were to stop it, that would include stopping HARP and pushing the jet stream around. And that's all part of the big part of the problem. All that cold air coming down the East Coast right now, there's a very interesting site that I've been watching, and it has to do with HARP awareness. It basically shows, and it certainly seems that what the discussion is correct, and that is that they've located some other HARP, several large arrays on a little island off the coast of Baja, and that they were breaking the storms up right over the coast of California and pushing the jet stream north. And when the jet stream went north, goes north. In fact, I heard this before this all came down, as it just started. When the jet stream went north, it picked up that cold air and it turned and it dropped it right down the East Coast. Sure enough, that's what happened. What we have to do is stop the HARP, and we have to get them to stop pushing the jet stream around. And then you have to ask the question, well, aside from some intentional population reduction program, what is going on? It's hard, you know, sorting out the truth from the lies. There's a huge amount of lie, but then there's also a little truth thrown in, which is, you know, that's classic misinformation. You know, part of it, I have no idea what the answers are. other than I'm really of the conviction that we need to stop the HARP and moving the jet stream around, and we probably are going to have that same thing happen with all the other countries and places that are using HARP. Now, are the same people behind all of it? You know, possibly, because, you know, corporations are international, and I don't think there should be any doubt whatsoever that corporations are involved in what's going on with all this. I mean, how did Monsanto know that we needed to develop aluminum-resistant plants? The main question, well, they're part of the military-industrial complex. They've been doing contracts with the Navy and the Air Force and the government. The government, I'll put that in quotes, because it's only a part of the government that's the problem. I do know that there's a lot of really good people out there working for all these same agencies that have these bad apples in it that are really directing everything. It seems more and more obvious all the time that that's what's going on.
Well, as you've heard, Alan issued an appeal to listeners concerned about these issues to fund testing of the lichen for metals, such as aluminum, showing evidence of the climate engineering raining out on the ground but coming from the air, not naturally occurring in the soil. We go now to part of an interview with Wanda Allen. She's a New Hampshire resident who at the time had recently become aware of the geoengineering programs and began to make presentations at her local library. The sudden awareness to the reality of these operations being conducted in plain sight can be a jarring experience. Many who have had this experience can't believe how long it took them to finally see it. How can a veil be so strong to hide this reality from good, intelligent, caring humans on this planet? Well, we explore some of those reasons that could contribute to a delayed awareness. Let's go now to hear part of that interview with Wanda Allen. Wanda Allen, welcome to Another News.
Thank you for having me.
Well, Wanda, I watched your presentation that you gave earlier this year titled Look Up, and it was about geoengineering. You gave this in Bartlett, New Hampshire. Very interesting. You pulled a lot of peripheral information together under the geoengineering or climate engineering umbrella. And it makes sense because we've said on the show before, when you mess with the sky, you mess with everything, the web of life. Your experience in becoming aware of the ongoing weather control operations was something I think that happens to a number of people, but could you tell listeners what had happened to you?
Sure. I think it started, you know, there was a little bit of preview to it before I actually started noticing the skies, but I started spending winters out in Arizona, and I was learning about GMO foods and going organic, and also learning more and more about what goes on behind the scenes that I was not aware of. And I started signing petitions, and then when you start signing petitions, then more petitions come to you, and I became really aware of how things that were going on as far as our food and other things that I was really against, and thinking all along that our government was taking care of us and doing what we felt, you know, that looking in our best interest, and then realizing that really wasn't so. But going organic, I felt like I was going in a good direction, and I was taking care of things that mattered to me. And when I came back to New Hampshire, I, you know, really downsized and reduced my carbon footprint as much as possible, and was feeling incredibly good about it. And one afternoon, I just happened, it was in November, and I happened to go outside to play with my dog, and I looked up in the sky, and it was just filled with a milky white haze and all these trails that went from horizon to horizon. And I had this sinking feeling in my stomach that something was horribly wrong, that I had never seen something like that before, and I was wondering what on earth is going on. So, but I knew that it was never right and that I had never seen something like that before, mm-hmm. and it was such a contrast to the beautiful blue sky that it really stood out to me. So I asked some friends about it, and they told me to watch a movie, What in the World Are They Spraying? So I did, and it answered everything, pretty much. It was exactly what I was seeing in the sky, and from that point on, I knew that it was sort of the breaking point for me in that I had to stand up and do something about it, that I just couldn't fathom the idea that somebody would actually take control of our weather and do what they're doing and, you know, think that it was okay.
Could you tell listeners about the experience that you had when you began to speak with friends and relatives about what you were seeing and you began to share this information with others? What had happened?
You know, it was interesting because it's a big fine line. And I think for me also in this whole journey has been a big learning about human behavior and how people react to things. Now, my closest friends were very concerned with me, and because it upset me enough that I literally cried for 4 months, and I knew that either it was going to make or break me, and I felt that I had to do something about it. So while they were pushing me forward in learning more about it or to do something about it and not let it get to me, I forced them to come along with me and make them see what was happening. It was like you can't just ignore it and pretend that it's not there. So luckily for me, my mom and my daughter, people that I was really, really close to, they immediately believed it and they would listen to me and, you know, in explaining all these things, and they're very aware of it, so I'm able to talk to them about it. But then other friends who, one was an environmental lawyer, and I thought for sure she, of all people, would be so interested in this, and she just shut it down completely and said that it was perfectly normal and that contrails had always spread out over the sky, and unfortunately, we just sort of had to go our separate ways.
Sounds difficult, Wanda, and I'm sure a lot of listeners can relate to that who have been in similar situations. We've had on a guest, his name is Tom Slate, and he is out there in California, and he had really presented a very simple but effective response to your environmental lawyer friend, which would be, well, how do you know for sure that that is normal? Because I'm interested. What data are you looking at? And that it's a very simple response, but very, very effective.
Yes, I think that. But also, I think it has been set up against us. There's been a huge amount of time spent and money, I'm sure, to keep this from coming out. And so there is a lot of disinformation out there as well. And I feel that people who really don't want to deal with this issue immediately go to that disinformation, and it makes them feel better. And then they can say, okay, now I can just set it aside and not have to think about it because this person says it's okay. Rather than trusting your own instincts and your own gut feeling, which I feel that we've certainly gotten away from, that we trust what the TV will say or we trust what the professionals will say, rather than questioning ourselves and going, does that really sit right with me? I think that we've gotten away from that a little bit.
Yes, indeed. And Carl Jung says a lot of people have two personalities. One is the very natural self that will speak its mind, and the other, it's a persona in a sense. But the real natural self is the one with the intuition that would know that something's wrong. And a lot of people aren't as in touch with that part of themselves. That's what Carl Jung was setting up in a way.
It makes sense. Yes.
Were there any other significant interactions that you want to share with the listeners?
I felt there was one. I've always been a huge nature person, so in some ways I even beat up on myself. How did it take me so long not to see this because I'm outside gardening or recreating and that sort of thing? But I have a friend who is an instructor, an outdoor instructor for climbing and hiking and that sort of thing, and I reached out to her and just saying, wow, you're out there in these big western skies. You must see this everywhere. And she out and out told me that she didn't want to watch any videos or get any information because she did not want to be sad. And I tried to express to her that, you know, we have always taken from nature. We take it for granted. We love that that we can go out and be in the woods and listen to the birds or to go on a mountaintop or all these beautiful, wonderful things. But when it comes time for us to take care of it, you know, who is going to speak for it? It can't speak for itself. And so I was quite angry with her for saying she didn't want to be sad, but she still wanted to be out and enjoy everything that it has to offer. But I think even still, with somebody denying that much, though, once that seed is planted, it must be incredibly difficult to fight that that knowledge, you know, that, you know, you do look at the sky no matter what, and it's got to hit you, so it must be hard to deny it, I guess, in their own, even though they are denying it.
It is a topic that does tend to separate people, and I know it can be examined among gender as well. Have you noticed anything in terms of awareness regarding women and men?
Yes, absolutely. I find that women, say, between the ages of 35 and up, are very receptive to it and are very upset about it and feel sort of this nurturing feeling towards it, even though the two friends that I mentioned before were women. But in general, I found that that women were more willing to take a little action towards it or at least believe it. And then the men I found were like, putting it off, no way, can't happen, it's not happening. And I questioned it and wondered if it was harder for men to feel vulnerable as opposed to women. You know, maybe, and not, it sounds, I don't know, not to say that women are vulnerable, but I think they're more in a nurturing state and that sort of thing. And maybe that's where they're more willing to be open to it, whereas men are like, we're the protectors. And really, having these planes in the sky spraying chemicals on us is a very vulnerable position to be in, and it's hard to accept that, I think.
Yes, it's a massive intrusion. There's almost nothing anyone can do right now. We're bringing awareness, but no one is going to the airbase to protest or stand in front of an aircraft taking off that's ready to go into these weather control operations. I would say you had a painful awareness process, but you did actively do something. Now, you did have a skiing story. Do you want to tell that one?
Yeah. Well, you know, because I found out in November, and I am a very much an outdoorsy type of person, and two of my closest friends who were very concerned about me at the time, because I feel that it absolutely was a grieving process. You know, it took me a while to figure it out, you know, what it was, but I literally was grieving because the world that I thought was is not. And I think that's one of the hardest things for people to come to grips with. We all have this idea of what our world is, and when you find out that that just simply is not true, you do go through a grieving process. So they insisted that I get outside, and this winter was horrible with the spraying because we would have these, you know, we have this pristine, well, it's not pristine snow because of the ice nucleation, you know, but there's, so it snowed a lot, and they would force me to go out, but I would turn around and force them at the same time to watch the planes and see what they do. And I just said, so you know that this is just not me, you know, coming up with these ideas. And also where we live, we don't have planes. It's not normal for us to have planes here. So to see these planes, like within the 2 hours that we would be out skiing in the woods, the skies would completely go from pristine, beautiful blue to whiteout conditions. And so they were forced to watch it, and there was no way that they could deny what was going on. And but it's interesting how they settle into it. And I think it takes different people obviously react different ways. And there is a knowledge. I think there's a huge knowledge out there of people that do know about this that don't necessarily take action on it. And then there are those of us that are so upset by it that we're almost, we just feel driven every day to try to do something to bring light to it and to stop it from happening.
Why would you want to live in a world where this is going on and no one is saying anything? As many say, silence is consent. You're, by default, you're consenting to allow this, just similar to the smart meter issue as well. Then you felt compelled to put together a presentation, and I thought it was really, really good. And you divided up the operations into military application and climate engineering. And let's go into the airline industry, because I thought that was interesting what you've researched on that. Can you tell listeners about that a bit?
Sure. You know, there's several things. I mean, for one thing, once you discover this, or once I discovered this, and I feel others do this as well, it's like your eyes never leave the skies anymore. You know, it's like you're constantly watching out to what are they going to do next, and then realizing, being 52 years old, that I had never seen, rarely ever even seen a contrail ever form, and then we might have military jets that do the supersonic fast up through our mountains, but even they never left a trail, or we would have like a little twin prop engine type thing come by and they never left a trail. So I think that's why it was such a screaming reality to me when I saw these planes leaving trails. And in watching them and then learning about the high bypass turbofan jet engines that are not water injected, and they go through this whole process, so it's really difficult for them to leave a trail. It's so rare. And they would fly behind our mountains, and then there, you know. So it didn't matter where they went or what time of year or what the humidity level was or how cold it was. I mean, the whole thing, it doesn't matter. They would leave a trail. And then I have seen them also flying together where one is going by leaving a very short trail, the next one right behind it is leaving a very long trail, another one will come in leaving a short trail. So they're all spraying in whatever capacity and whatever that they're doing, and the sky always changes. Whatever is happening with them, it always was changing.
Last year and the year before, you would hear about somebody trying to light a snowball on fire, and it would have a plastic burning smell. It would turn black.
Yes. And,
or it would turn into a sludge. There was a woman out in New Jersey a couple years ago who took images of this gel that was all over her car. And, well, listeners know about the product called Dyno Gel that is used in climate engineering as well. And I want to remind listeners that we're speaking with Wanda Allen, and she's in New Hampshire. So this is the area of the country that we're kind of talking about. Now, in your presentation, you also talked about the known side effects of climate engineering. And among them is occluding the sun and the fungus and mold that proliferates, decline in photosynthesis, and then also the vitamin D creation in the body declines, making you more vulnerable to disease and viruses. But some of the other effects to the overall weather system and environment, can you talk about that for a minute?
Yeah, you know, the other thing too is an interesting factor that I have found out in speaking with people and having professionals come back and talk to me as well. One of the things that just happened is the Alzheimer's Association, you know, because aluminum is associated with Alzheimer's, and one in three people die with dementia or Alzheimer's, and maybe not from it, but with it, and it's found in their brain tissue. And the Alzheimer's Association did not want Dane Wigington, who is from Geoengineering Watch, lichens.org. Yeah, they didn't want him to purchase a booth at one of their events, and they sent him an email, and they said the reason why was because that they had not found that aluminum was associated with Alzheimer's. So, of course, there's a shock right there, but and it's known, you know, the ADA, you know, all of the thing, the autism and all of that. But the other thing that I found out during my presentation is that Roundup helps facilitate aluminum to pass the blood-brain barrier, as well as fluoride. Both of those things help facilitate metals and into the blood-brain barrier. And
you're absolutely right. That was
that's huge.
Yeah.
That's huge.
It's a big deal. Fluoride. So if you're drinking fluoridated water, listeners, and you're breathing air that has aluminum particulates, nanoparticulates in it, then it's leaching into your brain.
Exactly. Exactly. And it and the other thing too that a lot of people don't know about, but you know, the whole HARP system and all of the extra low frequencies, the ELFs, and that is emitted around us, and particularly in cities, it's even worse. But with all the cell towers and the Gwen towers and even the NEXRAD towers and all of these towers, and if there was some way to, like in a movie, when you see that they spray to see where the red the laser lines are, or you know, the infrared, it's like if we could see how many frequencies were flying around us, and they also are on, you know, it's all in the same frequencies as our hearts and our brains. So, and they have showed, you know, there's been studies where they've used it as a type of torture to be able to do mind control. So it can make you very sad, or it can make you very happy or angry, or all these different emotions. And they use these frequencies to, you know, move jet streams, move the clouds wherever they want them to go, and all of that sort of thing. So that's like a whole other aspect that we're being hit with that people don't know about. And you might go, why do I feel this way? There's no reason for me to feel this sad, or, you know, why am I so angry? Or, and it's interesting that the research that I've done on finding out how these frequencies really affect how you think, and it's a scary thought there.
When you begin to spray metallic salts, metals in the air, and then you use ionospheric heaters and electromagnetic weapons or devices, you're going to be able to move the clouds around, and you're going to be able to make images in these clouds.
They do talk about also creating somewhat of a plasma screen also with the aluminum, you know, the metal particles. And I know in Arizona, in Fort Huachuca, they actually have done quite a bit of research down there and putting up holograms. And it all sounds so futuristic, and you think, no way, you know, what they would have told us.
It's critical to remind listeners that programs such as solar radiation management are being conducted in real time right now. You may have noticed the aircraft releasing aerosol in the skies over New York City the past few days. That's a geoengineering program. These operations are done in secret and in plain sight. You could look at the many aspects of conditioning that prevents maybe a lot of people from seeing this, such as lying by omission, normalizing the visual effects of the operations to children by embedding unnatural skies into animation films. The list goes on. About 5 years ago, there were many Skywatch groups creating awareness in different parts of the United States, bringing the voices of these activists onto the airwaves in a massive radio market. Over the years was a type of leverage needed to bring awareness to what others were seeing in different parts of the country. We go now to Arizona and hear some of a past interview with Bridget Conroy and Mike Carraway with Arizona Skywatch. Bridget is a former educator of special needs children. She developed augmented communication devices and personal therapy techniques to help special needs children be included in the regular classroom. Mike Carraway is an information technology professional and has been active in resisting the geoengineering operations for many years. Let's go to hear some of that interview.
HARP is one of the most underreported stories anywhere. Oh, now we have Fox TV and people saying, oh, yeah, come on and speak about chemtrails. Of course, they massage the whole thing and edit it. But HARP, certainly in controlling the weather, Dr. Bernard Eastland, one of his first patents before, and I think he was with ARCO at that time or had sold it to ARCO, was weather modification.
I agree. You know, when the chemtrails first started being sprayed in Arizona in 98 every day, and it came to light that aluminum and barium were two of the main metals that were being used, the question was why. And luckily at that time, in the early days of the Internet, even before 98, there had been word from Alaska. What was his name, Bridget?
Nick Begich.
Yeah, Nick Begich. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry. Nick Begich, who was a member of a very strong political family in Alaska. His dad was a senator who had died in a suspicious air crash. But anyway, he came out with Angels Don't Play This Harp, and he brought to light this harp installation in Alaska. And he also formed a pretty close friendship with Bernard Eastland, who got the patents, and in the main harp patent had mentioned barium as being an important part of propagating the waves from harp. And Bernard Eastland also was very forthcoming, especially in the later years of his life, about what harp could do. And I think he might have had second thoughts about the work that he had done, because he was a scientist interested in the possibilities of harp, but it was definitely being taken over by the military. You have a really effective technology. The military gets first dibs on it. Mm-hmm. So
yes.
It became pretty clear that the metals, not only aluminum and barium, but there's about 15 metals that were identified in the chemtrails, are all used to convert our atmosphere into a plasma or a medium that can propagate these electronic waves. And the atmosphere, the way it was, where it was mostly water vapor, is not as conducive to that. If you think of the early days of television or radio with a lot of interference, and with the chemtrails and the metals in the air now, and they're pretty much established now, and they have improved them so that they can, these particulates are so small, and they're also responsive to the sunlight. They self-levitate, and they stay in the atmosphere much longer, so they don't need to be sprayed as much. They just need to be, sort of renewed, throw some extra ones in there to keep them refreshed. But this plasma that is our atmosphere now, you might say it has a good effect in that we can directly contact our satellites with our smartphones now, and this plasma actually helps to further that also, but its main objective is these HARP installations that are, HARP was originally an ionospheric heater that sends microwaves to the ionosphere. It ionizes the ionosphere even further and can manipulate and fuse the molecules in the ionosphere into a lens that can then be directed to heat up various parts of the ocean.
Right.
Or it also sends back extra low frequency waves down to the earth for deep earth tomography to spot oil or water or military installations under the earth.
Or gold.
Or gold,
yeah.
Just about anything, because everything has a frequency that can be detected. And now these HARP installations have proliferated around the world, mostly up toward the north. There's seven or eight, a friend of ours that used to work for NATO has confirmed there's seven or eight of them in Scandinavia, Norway and Sweden. There's supposed to be some in Spain and in Siberia. This is now a grid that encircles our planet, and so the chemtrails act as the medium to propagate these waves. HARP was, we do have an article on our site about HARP and colony collapse disorder. In the summer of 2006, colony collapse disorder started, or in the fall of 2006, and then it was brought to the forefront in the spring of 2007, and they had actual congressional hearings on it. But the fall of 2006, or the late summer, is exactly when HARP ramped up its output. In the early days, when it first started, it was called a research project. That was part of the RP and HARP.
Right, exactly.
And so it was less energy at that time, but it was always intended. Eventually it was sold to the U.S. Navy, and I don't know if the Navy has it now or the Air Force, but it was ramped up in 2006 to be much more energy than ever before. It just so happens that the bees, the spectrum of light energy that they used to navigate was interfered with by this HARP transmissions.
Right.
And that's when they started losing their way. We never knew bees to just abandon the hive. That goes against all their instincts.
Mike, can you tell us a little bit about some of the best ways to organize, to bring awareness to these aerosol operations and these massive geoengineering operations?
Jeff, we really believe in state sovereignty, and that's one of the struggles that's going on in Arizona, as you know, with the immigration issue. We're lucky to have the state legislature close to us here. I know in some states it would be kind of far away, or it might be hard to reach your state legislators, but they're very approachable here. And we feel that the federal government was formed as a contract between the states, and it's supposed to serve the states and actually the God-given rights of the individual. And so the states, the legislature has the power to insist on that. And in our legislature, we told them about the precedent in New Mexico, where New Mexico claimed, the legislature claimed sovereignty over the New Mexico airspace mm-hmm. by requiring that airlines get a liquor license to sell liquor when they're flying over New Mexico. United Airlines refused, and so the state legislature was going to ban them from flying over the state. And then United finally gave in and said that they wouldn't serve alcohol over New Mexico. And that's a sort of precedent we tried to tell our legislators about, that you have the power to extend mm-hmm. the sovereignty of the state and of the people mm-hmm. right up into the air over the state. Of course, a lot of them are very worried about the budget issues, and most legislators are preoccupied with that.
That's designed,
But we are trying to encourage them to, even in a small way, with like compact fluorescent light bulbs, which are mandated in some places, to in a small way assert the sovereignty of the state as the primary sovereignty of the people for the rights and the freedom of the people to breathe clean air and whatever the other issues are.
Yeah, Mike's point is well taken by me. Working regionally, given our Bill of Rights, by state, wish people could summon their courage. And I know it's intimidating to go down and speak to these people, but they're ordinary people. They have to speak to you.
And they have families, too. They're human beings, so you can appeal to them with our common interests as humans.
That's going to do it for In Other News. I'm Jeff Brady.